persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-749, Emissor Nurkson, S.A. Appellant, International Bank of Reconstruction and Development, L. Andrew Prucky, Mr. Brad Medjep, Mr. Brooks, for the appellant, Mr. Petron, for the athletes.
Your Honors, good morning.
Good morning, Counsel.
The World Bank is not immune from answering interrogatories in this non-wage garnishment proceeding. The District Court erred in holding otherwise. Three independent bases exist for determining that the World Bank is not so immune. First, the non-wage garnishment proceeding in this instance satisfies the commercial activities exception to immunity. Second, the express waiver of immunity in the World Bank's Articles of Agreement encompasses this non-wage garnishment proceeding. And third, the World Bank waived whatever immunity it might possess by failing to seek judicial relief in a timely and proper fashion. With respect to the commercial activities exception, it is clear from a full review of the legislative history that the World Bank does not enjoy, and no international organization under the IOIA so enjoys, absolute immunity. I recognize that there is language in the decision of this court in Atkinson to the contrary. But Atkinson Part 3, in fact, is dicta. It was unnecessary to reach the determination made in Atkinson. It is no different than the case presented before the panels of this court in Broadbent, in Tuck, or in Rendell Speranza. In those three cases, starting with Broadbent, this court held that where immunity would exist under either the absolute doctrine or under the restrictive doctrine by virtue of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, there was no reason to reach the decision as to whether the IOIA grants absolute or restrictive immunity. That same decision, that same holding rather, appears in a decision a year later written by Judge Edwards in Tuck versus Pan American Health Organization. Yet another panel in 1997 in the Rendell Speranza case, a panel on which Judge Santel sat, affirmed the holdings in both Broadbent and Tuck that where there is immunity under either situation, it is not necessary to reach the determination as to whether the IOIA grants absolute or restrictive immunity.
It's an alternative holding. How do we ignore it?
It's an alternative holding insofar as it's wedged between Part 2, which assumes arguendo that immunity is absolute under the IOIA, and Part 4, which holds that even if it were not, there's a determination under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act would preclude a wage garnishment proceeding from falling within the exception to immunity. As a result, that is exactly the counterbalance that was faced by Broadbent and Tuck. And those two panels refused to reach because the conclusion would be the same either way. Those two panels refused to reach the ultimate decision as to whether the IOIA confers absolute immunity. Therefore, it's really more of dicta than an alternative holding. The legislative history of the IOIA, when reviewed more fully than this court was briefed in Atkinson, confirms that the IOIA, in fact, does not confer absolute immunity. The House report, for example, states that the immunity provisions of the IOIA our standard in light of the available precedent.
That's an awfully thin reed, Counsel. Rather, if not tortured, at least labored interpretation of the legislative history of an act isn't much to go on.
Well, I would agree if, in fact, it were tortured, Your Honor. I tend to think that it's not, and I think
that sound labored.
Well, I think
the use of the word available is what you're relying on.
Not only, quite to the contrary, both the House report and the Senate report go on to say that the IOIA immunity provisions are, quote, somewhat more limited than the immunities enjoyed by foreign governments and their diplomats, their personnel, their diplomatic personnel.
Yeah.
Say again, please.
What do the words of the statute say?
The words of the statute of 288A subsection B says the same as the immunity enjoyed by foreign sovereigns.
Right. That's what was enacted by the Congress. Both houses voted on that.
There is no
signed it, and that's the law.
There is no question, but there's a question as to what is meant by same as. It is.
And that, I don't know where that gets you anywhere with that, the legislative history. It doesn't get you anywhere with regard to that. The question you're dealing with is whether same as means same as now prevails, or whether same as means same as prevails at the time of litigation in question.
Correct. Well, the same as language refers to whether or not
even if we were looking at the legislative history, it really not doesn't speak to that.
With due respect, I believe it speaks to the issue of what Congress intended to confer. With respect to the legal analysis, where Your Honor, I believe, is going, with respect to what was the state of the law circa 1945 at the time of the enactment of the IOIA, it's clear that, in fact, absolute immunity was not the state of the law with respect to foreign sovereign immunity at the time. This was confirmed 10 months prior to the adoption of the IOIA in Republic of Mexico versus Hoffman. And this is not surprising, given that the view of the State Department with respect to absolute immunity is that it has not existed since at least 1927. This is the Kellogg letter referenced in the brief to Attorney General Sargent in 1927, in which he states unequivocally that the Department of State for some time, as of 1927, for some time, has held the view that the commercial activities of foreign sovereigns does not result in any immunity for the foreign sovereign with respect to those activities. That is, although the Tate letter, in fact, formally adopted the restrictive theory of sovereign immunity in 1952, it's clear that 25 years prior to that, the State Department, whether formally or otherwise, had adopted that theory. And since the State Department was the entity that drafted the IOIA, it's rather clear that they intended to build into that their beliefs of restrictive and absolute immunity as it existed in 1945. Even if, however, the commercial activities exception was not built into the IOIA, the IOIA has been impacted by the subsequent passage of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. This is clear both from the Robert Owen letter, writing contemporaneously with the passage of the FISA, and this is found on page 17 of the principal brief, where he states that the FSIA means that international organizations are now subject to jurisdiction of United States courts regarding their commercial activities. That is exactly the position in which we find ourselves. That statement was ratified on the very day that this court determined Atkinson in the passage by Congress of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act amendments of 1998. In which they sought to clarify the law of immunity under the IOIA and stated unequivocally that the immunity does not extend. In that particular instance, they were discussing international telecommunications industry does not extend to this industry because of their commercial activities.
Would the World Bank have immunity under any circumstances, in your view?
Oh, there's no question. I think that...
Under what circumstances would the World Bank have immunity, or is everything the World Bank does a commercial activity?
Well,
I'm trying to sort this one out from the other cases that might be brought against.
Absolutely. I think that the decision in Mandera that starts a line of cases that somewhat limits the decision in Lucher, holding that a distinction must be made between the internal activities and operations of the World Bank and the external activities and operations of the World Bank, is a very good start.
So their immunity would extend only to their internal operations?
Certainly to their internal operations. If you go back to the seminal decision by Judge Berger in 1967 in the Lucher case, a very fair read of that case, which in fact in Note 7 goes into the legislative history, is that the Section 3 waiver in the Articles of Agreement of the World Bank is a blanket waiver of immunity. To the extent, I would be very happy were the court to reinvigorate the decision in Lucher and make that the guideline for its external operations. Certainly, the court has made clear that whatever limitations may exist, those limitations do not extend to parties that have any sort of relationship directly with the bank. So, for example, if Energoprojekt were a direct contractor of the World Bank, if it were the construction firm that had been hired to build a new office for the World Bank in another country, its funds would be subject to garnishment. There's no question, because it would be able to sue the World Bank, and the World Bank would not enjoy immunity. The funds through which it would be paid should therefore likewise not be subject to immunity. In this case, even if we fall outside of the Mandera standard, and I believe we do not, the World Bank here still does not enjoy immunity because it has waived its immunity. It has waived it not only in its articles of agreement, but it has waived it by failing to come forward in a timely fashion and in a proper fashion and assert its claim of immunity, as was required by the state of the law of sovereign immunity circa 1945. I see that my time for argument in chief has expired. I thank the court.
Thank you, sir.
We'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Let me start with one of the last things Mr. Brooks mentioned, where he was suggesting that the World Bank's immunity would have been waived if Energoprojekt were a direct contractor with the World Bank. Whether that's true or not, that's simply not the facts of this case. This case arises out of a transaction between Inversor Merton and Energoprojekt that is entirely unrelated to the World Bank. According to the complaint that was filed in New Jersey court in 1995 that led to the judgment here against Energoprojekt, there's the transaction at issue related to some project that those two entities were engaged in the Republic of Guinea. There's nothing there that indicates any connection to the World Bank. There's nothing anywhere in the record that says the underlying transaction has anything to do with the World Bank. So the World Bank is simply a stranger to the underlying transaction at issue here. And in a case like this, under this court standard in Mandaro, there is simply no advantage to the World Bank in having waived its immunity to an action like this. There's no waiver, and under Atkinson, the World Bank is absolutely immune. Now, Inversora has made, a number of, I think, potentially interesting arguments about why Atkinson might be wrongly decided, but at least at this point, Atkinson is the binding precedent of this court. There is no reason to think that Part 3 of Atkinson is somehow not entitled to stare decisis just because it was an alternative holding. If that were the rule, Your Honors, then any case with an alternative holding would have no holding whatsoever, and what Inversora has suggested would be the holding of Atkinson would also not be entitled to stare decisis effect because it, too, is an alternative holding. This court regularly affords stare decisis effect to alternative holdings. It routinely cites the alternative holdings of its prior precedents. Part 3 of Atkinson is a holding of this court, and it's binding on this case. There's no waiver of the absolute immunity of the World Bank here because under Mendaro, a waiver has to be necessary for the bank to accomplish its chartered objectives. And that's simply not the case here. The best story that Inversora could tell you about how there is some advantage to the World Bank in a case like this is that somehow garnishment interrogatories would provide the World Bank with information about entities that contract with the member nations of the World Bank on its projects. But there are certainly plenty of other ways that the World Bank could get that information. As we noted in our brief, counsel for Inversora could have sent a letter to the World Bank containing that information. It's simply unnecessary for the World Bank to waive its immunity to get whatever benefit Inversora thinks would obtain here. And absent that necessity, under Mendaro, there is no waiver in the bank's articles of agreement. One other thing I think I should mention is, you know, some of the substantive arguments that Inversora has made concerning whether Atkinson was correctly decided or whether the FSIA somehow modifies the absolute immunity of an international organization are simply mistaken. And for example, Inversora just mentioned the 1998 amendments to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act as somehow confirming that the FSIA applies to international organizations. If you look at the relevant statutory section of the 1998 FCPA amendments, you'll see that it applies by its express terms only to international organizations that provide commercial communication services. That's not the World Bank. And what's more, an international organization that supplies commercial communication services is specifically defined in the 1998 amendments as the International Telecommunications Satellite Organization and the International Mobile Communications, Mobile Satellite Organization. Neither of those are the World Bank. So that argument is beside the point, as are most of the other arguments on the merits. Atkinson decides the question of whether the World Bank is absolutely immune. It's binding here. That immunity has not been waived in
the
district.
Are you essentially arguing that Mendaro can carry the day even if Atkinson isn't there?
Mendaro addressed the issue of a waiver of the immunity.
Right.
And the standard is that the waiver of an immunity would have to be necessary for the bank's objectives. We would say under that standard, it's certainly not necessary in this case for the bank to waive its immunity to a garnishment proceeding in order to carry out its chartered
Mendaro
objectives.
Mendaro would carry the day as to that issue.
As to that issue.
As to
the waiver issue. Unless there's anything further, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
How much time does counsel have left for rebuttal? Okay, we'll hear your rebuttal, counsel.
Mr. Patron has indicated that Mendaro has a necessary standard. In fact, that is not the standard of Mendaro. Mendaro first notes that external relations suits, such as those that arose in Luther, waive the bank's immunity from actions arising out of the bank's external relations. This is exactly that kind of situation. There is no need for there to be in a garnishment proceeding a nexus between the judgment creditor and the garnishee. That is axiomatic. The nexus that exists here is between the garnishee and the judgment debtor. That is Energoproject. The World Bank's rules, internal rules, state unequivocally that it is to be involved in the determination of contractors on projects it finances. The contractor is to be paid out of assets that are segregated and earmarked for that project. As Judge Henderson wrote in the BCCI case, that sort of segregation effectively results in an abandonment of title to those funds from the World Bank. Those funds, therefore, are the property, ultimately, of the contractor. There is, therefore, a pool of funds that is subject to garnishment. As this court held in 2001 in the Dujardin case, the World Bank has waived its immunity from suit brought by debtors, creditors, bondholders, and those other potential plaintiffs as to whom the bank would have subjected itself to suit in order to achieve its chartered objectives. Those chartered objectives, as indicated in the joint appendix at page 197, include procurement. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Call the next case.